Meanwhile, in Justice League Quarterly number 3, cover dated summer 1991. Hello, and welcome to the Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. This episode is another of our Meanwhile episodes, and these Meanwhile episodes break from the usual numbered issues to provide a chance to look at the JLI outside of the ongoing monthly series. This time out, we're discussing the third installment in the spinoff Justice League Quarterly. Now, my name is the Irredeemable Shag, and I am your host, but I'm not doing this alone. Thankfully, I'll be joined by another JLI fan to help me cover the issue. My co-host today is a good friend of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. He's also an ideal guest for this episode. See, in this comic, General Glory's dog, Liberty, finally gets to meet Power Girl's cat, and then the fur really flies. And in real life, this guest has fur flying in his own home with two cats, and the cats are named, wait for it, Flash and Nightwing. That's awesome. Folks, please help me welcome Mr. Steve Givens. Welcome to the embassy, Steve. Thanks for being here, man. How you doing?
I'm doing great, Shag. Thanks for having me here. Flash and Nightwing are doing great, too. They were here and ready to sit on this episode with me, but then they heard your voice and had to leave. They were like, we don't have time for this. And they've been known for their impeccable taste, so I understand why they wanted to leave.
That makes perfect sense. I do have to apologize, folks. My voice is still very, very froggy. Being around Steve, it's like a natural allergic reaction to talking with Steve. So I apologize if I'm going to be a little gruff this time.
It's a talent I've honed over years of teaching teenagers. You know, I just being able to have that effect on people. But you know what, Shag? Thanks for inviting me to the embassy. I've never been here. The only problem is, dude, it smells in here. Why does it smell like stale Oreos and burnt hair? Yeah, and is that dog poop I smell? What does anybody ever clean up in this place? What's going on?
Well, actually, I'm glad you're here because it's actually the guest responsibility to clean up the embassy. So glad you're here. I'm going to get you a broom and a dustpan and a mop.
I'm going to need more than a broom and a dustpan and a mop from what I'm smelling in this place. I need like a fire starter or something, you know, something.
As we get through the issue, I think you're going to understand where some of the mess is coming from. Now, before we get too much further, though, we do need to take a second to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of the JLI Podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStockTrades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping on orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode, we'll select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the InStockTrades library, and usually it's tied into this month's JLI issue in some way, shape, or form. Mine's pretty tangential, but I couldn't resist. I picked Ant-Man Marvel Universe Digest. So this is, Marvel published a number of digests, not like the kind you get in the grocery store, like the Archie Digest, but they're more just a smaller version of the comic book publication. Like this one's 88 pages, and it collects a whole bunch of the kid-friendly kind of comics that Marvel put out a few years back, including Marvel Adventure Superheroes and Marvel Universe Avengers or Smitty's Heroes, things along those lines, and it all is focused on Ant-Man, and obviously this was released to coincide with some of the previous movies, but in this he's fighting Psycho Man and then dealing with the Microverse and Sandman and Power Man and Iron Fist are in it. Looks like so much fun. I absolutely love these digests. I have a whole bunch of them myself. Normally retails for only $9.99, but you can get it for 41% off. So it's only $5.89. That's amazing. You know, throw that in there with a couple other books and you'll get free shipping. So only $5.89 for the Ant-Man Marvel Universe Digest trade paperback. Now, Steve, all my other guests over the course of the last 6 years where we've been doing this show have brought an in-stock trades recommendation. That means that they're high quality. I seriously doubt that you were prepared enough to do it, but I have to ask by law, did you bother to bring a recommendation? It's okay. You can say no.
I most certainly did bring a recommendation. Whoa. I have been waiting for an opportunity through all the shows I've done with you guys to do an in-stocks trade recommendation. Every time I ask, everyone's always like, no, you don't have to do one. Like, you're afraid of my recommendation. What are you guys afraid of, Shag?
I fear what you might come up with. I didn't see Cherry Pop Tart out there, so.
Well, you know, that's going to be for another show, another time.
Okay.
All right. Anyway, so hopefully I'm not getting us ahead of ourselves with my recommendation, but I'm a sucker for a good time travel romp. You know, give me time loops, give me paradoxes, give me timelines that look like a Gordian knot. I mean, seriously, the crazier, the better. All right. So for my choice, I had to go with Chrononauts Volume 1, written by Mark, is it Millar or Miller?
Millar.
This is Millar. Okay.
At least that's what he told me over coffee the other day.
Okay, I got it. Well, there's crazy Scots in their pronunciation. And it's also drawn by Sean Murphy. It's published by Image. The trade is a 120-page full-color story about two characters, Corbin Quinn and Danny Riley, who are not entirely dissimilar from a certain blue and gold team that may come up in our discussion today.
Oh, the X-Men. I love that.
Yes, exactly. Those guys. These two buds, they traipse through time and cause all sorts of havoc, sometimes inadvertently and sometimes on purpose. Originally priced at $9.99, in stock has it for the bargain price of $5.79 at 42% off, making the price a full 10 cents cheaper than the Shark Stag just tried to push on you poor unsuspecting folks. So, as we go along in this episode, ladies, and probably mostly gentlemen, think about whose opinion you can trust. Mine? I'm the one trying to save you as much money as possible. Or Shags, the guy who is literally trying to squeeze every last dime out of you that he can.
What are you, running for office on your in-stock trades recommendation? A vote for Steve Gibbons is a vote for decency, folks.
Exactly, you know.
Oh, my gosh. All right. All right, folks, for these and all your other trade paperback needs, please visit instocktrades.com. You know, between those two, you can pick them both up for like less than 12 bucks. That's great. Also, folks, this episode is sponsored in part with your Patreon support.
Speaking of squeezing money out of people.
Because running the Fire and Water Podcast Network with so many shows requires a whole lot of online hosting and other services. And a while back, we realized we needed some help with some of the expenses.
Yeah, somebody's got to pay for all those sweaty Florida lap dances that Shag likes.
Could you just shut up? So, folks, we needed your help. We launched the Patreon, and you folks really stepped up to help keep the network going.
And keep those Florida strippers in fresh G-strings.
I can press the hang-up button anytime I want.
Fresh G-strings, anyway, I don't know.
I got a line of people that would love to talk about this issue, okay? Don't blow this for yourself. So if you're enjoying the JLI podcast...
I would learn to live with the disappointment, Chad.
Just shut up. The best way to support the show and the network is by visiting our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. And while you're there, please consider supporting the Firewater Podcast Network. In a certain tiers, you get mentioned on the show of your choice. Just like these folks who asked to be recognized on the JLI podcast. Because obviously, these people have a refined sense of dignity. Unlike some other patrons who choose to be recognized on a different show, like, I don't know, Mr. Givens. So our thanks go out to Chris Lewis, David A. Gutierrez, DC Dave, Devin Clancy, George Van Note, Gord Tolden, John Coos, John Ross Haynes, Kevin Wetter, Mark Baker Wright, Martin Gray, Matt Ev, Maxwell Traver, Michael Crouch, Michael Zomkowski, Patrick McMullen, Roger Priebe, Rudy Castillo, Sean Ross, Superman Radio Revisited Podcast, and Tim Price, and what the hell, I'll say Steve Givens. Again, please visit our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcast. Oh, you are going to be a handful. It's like dealing with two cats all of a sudden, isn't it?
In all seriousness, even though I make fun of Shag in general, I mean, I was making fun of the Patreon thing. These guys put together a really great network. And if you can support them, do so, because the shows they put out are well worth the support and well worth your time and listening and just being there for them.
Wow. That was really incredibly kind and heartfelt. And
yeah.
I don't even recognize you.
I have my moments, you know.
Well, folks, this moment is all about you, because we want you now to join the conversation. Get out on the social medias, tag us at JLI Podcast on Facebook or Twitter. Use the hashtag FW Podcast if you want. It's all about building an online community of JLI fans around the show. So again, thank you so much to all the patrons. Thank you, folks, who get involved and leave your comments. Thank you for the folks on the social media. All of you guys are fantastic and really, really make this worthwhile and worth doing and making it fun. So thank you so much. Now, the antithesis of that would be giving Steve a platform to talk, which is what I'm about to do. So I apologize in advance, folks. So, Steve, this is the part of the show where I ask all the interesting guests and you, what is your personal origin story with the JLI? How'd you find the book? Is this your first time reading it? Did you bother even reading the issue before we came here today? You know, tell me.
Oh, wait a minute. I thought I was on Fade Out.
Right, exactly. We're here to talk about Silver Sorceress's last issue of Justice League.
Gotcha. Yeah, I know. Well, you know, I'm a comic book fan specifically.
Really? I hadn't noticed.
I know. Shocker. But specifically, I am a longtime Justice League fan, going back to the Satellite era. I'm not as old as you and Rob, so I don't remember pre-Satellite era Justice League. That was kind of my go-to Justice League when I was really little getting comics. And I'm joking about, you know, you guys being old.
Oh, I know. I just was tuning you out.
Oh, okay. Got it.
I was taking my blood pressure medicine. Go ahead.
When I became a quote-unquote serious comic book collector, though, and went to read the book regularly, it was already knee-deep into the Detroit era at that point. And for me at that time, that was that sweet spot age for comic book reading. So as deeply maligned as that era is, and as much as it was a, you know, a less than stellar moment for the team, I finally remember those characters, you know, even Vibe. And I was truly affected by the final story arc that ended the original series. Like, I followed that to the bitter end.
I know you probably don't listen to anything I ever say, so you probably haven't heard me say this before, and you're not going to hear it right now. But yeah, Justice League Detroit was my first era, too.
I do know that you said that, and I am shamed by that similarity between the two of us. And I was hesitant in admitting. And so I was, you know, this is a confessional as much as anything else.
I never liked you. Never.
All right. Well, anyway, that final story, of course, it took place during Legends. And Legends paved the way for a new incarnation of the League. Everybody knows what happened there. But as a young reader who was reading mostly DC at the time, I was all on board with the new version of the team. I just wanted Justice League. Plus, I had a subscription for the original series that hadn't run out by the time that last issue was published. So I was getting the new book, whether I wanted it or not. If memory serves, I think I got the first three issues of the new Justice League title in the mail.
Nice.
Now, for you youngins out there, just so you know, you could actually subscribe and get paper comics sent to you in the mail. And the U.S. Postal Service was at one time a semi-reliable way to receive your mail, even paper comics, albeit with the occasional scuff and wrinkle. It was a gentler and simpler time, kids, but I digress.
I hate to burst your bubble, but the average mean age of people listening are probably your age.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, you never know. I tend to bring in a younger demographic from what I'm told, so you may get some young people in here.
There's so many things wrong with that. If you're a high school teacher, I don't want to get you in trouble. So go ahead.
I'm just saying that I'm cool, and the kids respond to that, you know.
Yeah, I'm seeing that.
All right. So, you know, from the start of the Giffen DeMatteis run, I read every Justice League book on the stands, including the quarterly. And I stayed with the book after Giffen and DeMatteis left. And I mean, I stayed until the bitter end.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I know.
Dude, I read Extreme Justice, the whole series.
You've been through the wars, man.
Yes, I have. This is how bad my addiction to the Justice League was. I tell you, if Mark Waid's Midsummer's Nightmare hadn't come along, followed by the Morrison run, I think my family would have had to schedule an intervention or something.
You know, if I had to stack them, though, I would still put Extreme Justice probably before those last few issues of Justice League America with Yaz, the dinosaur, and all that stuff. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Oh, that was some rough reading.
Yes,
oh,
it was. God.
Anyway, in all seriousness, I have come to realize something about the JLI era of the team. And I'm going to preface this with saying that I am not doing any, I'm not trying to say anything derogatory about the team. I mean this more as a description than anything else. The humor and the hijinks, the sitcom feel to the stories, I find that it was all essentially part of a transitional stage for the Justice League. It was a highly successful and deservedly beloved stage, but it was a transitional one nonetheless. And what I mean by that is the Justice League is at its core, I think, meant to be a team of DC's best and brightest. But sometimes the core needs to be shaken up a little to keep it fresh and relevant. I think Jerry Conway tried to do that with the Detroit era league, and he took the team about as far away from the core concept as you could go. And the JLI era is a step towards getting the team back to its original premise as the DCU's premier team, but with some really fun zigging and zagging along the way. I mean, it was, I'm not denigrating that era. I'm just like, this was a transitional thing, you know, in many ways for me. So part of what makes me say all that is that by the time Breakdowns started, I personally was ready as a reader to move on from this area, that era. I didn't hate it. I wasn't like, ugh, I'm done. But I remember feeling like I need to go on to something else. And as a result, I never truly felt the need to go back for a deep dive into the JLI era books. That is until you dragged me onto this show kicking and screaming. I don't mean to say that I think the JLI is a lesser version of the team. I don't want anyone to come at me about this, but I always felt it to be a time period where the stories are very much what you see is what you get. In the best possible sense of that phrase, with the humor and the and what's being presented to you, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. And I think the Justice League does do this. Sometimes it just happens on its own. Other times, I think DC purposely schedules it where they go through, you know, the greatest group of superheroes, then take it down a notch to something else. Like you said, Justice League Detroit. I would say Justice League International starts as the best and brightest, but then probably around, I don't know, somewhere in the 30s of that series, it becomes something else. It becomes kind of the joke characters. It really does. Mm-hmm. And so then, well, it got even worse, as we said, after Giffen and DeMatteis left. But then it had to be built back up with Morrison. And then when Morrison left, you know, Robinson dragged it down to a bunch. So they keep doing an ebb and wave. And sometimes I think it's purposely planned. I don't keep up with it currently, but I know they put all the kids on the Justice League recently and killed the Justice League or something, and knowing full well the Justice League is going to come back. So I think they do this on purpose. And International's interesting because it's a little bit of both. Again, it started as the best and brightest, but then became the joke. So I can see what you mean. But I do think that there's a lot more meat on the bones, and maybe you're giving it credit for it, because there's a lot of stories. And this one's got a little bit of it in here, where it's, oh, it's ha, 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 it's joke, joke, joke. And then you're like, oh, you get punched in the gut. And you're like, oh, man.
Yeah.
And the emotional beats hit more because you're laughing every other panel. And so the emotional bits hit much more.
Oh, yeah. And I'm sorry, I didn't mean to imply that there wasn't anything there to a value. With the JLI stories, I just feel like what they're doing is very obvious.
Oh, yeah, you know? Absolutely.
Okay, that's what I mean. Yeah. By not that there's not any sort of like real depth to the stories at all. Although some of the stories are really kind of like silly to the point.
Oh, yeah.
Like, really? Okay.
It's supposed to be a workplace comedy. Mm-hmm. It absolutely is. There's no denying that at all. And it's an interesting experiment because, you know, Justice League before this had been the tried and true superhero, even when it was the young teens learning their way. This is the first time someone really was willing to risk their tentpole franchise and do something different.
It definitely worked. It definitely worked.
Oh, yeah.
This is a distinctive era of the Justice League. I understand why it's so beloved by people. It's beloved by me, but it's like, for me, I've never felt the need to ever really go back to it.
No, I understand. All your backpedaling makes perfect sense.
Clarification.
Is that what they call it? Yeah. So, and this issue actually is a really interesting example of where you've been and where you're going, because in this, you're going to find out in a second, or you've already read it, is there's a flashback to the original Justice League. And by being quarterly, this is the second spinoff of the Justice League book. The Justice League had never been popular enough to maintain two additional spinoffs up until this point. So it does go to show just how successful it was. So, all right, well, let's get into this, folks. So it's if you want to see some images from this issue, go out to our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com/JLI, and I will post some panels or pages from the issue so you can see some of the gloriousness that is Justice League Quarterly number 3. So our publisher, of course, is DC Comics. Cover dated is, at least on the cover, it's this summer 1991, but it actually was on the shelves April 23rd, 1991, had a cover price of $2.95. Ouch! Three times as much as a regular issue, but you're getting 80 pages, 80 whole pages. Now the cover is by, and this is a little weird, Almost every source online says this cover's by Bart Sears, but it is clearly not by Bart Sears. I think you'd agree with me. This has got to be a Mike McCone cover. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's definitely not Bart Sears.
You want to describe it to everybody?
Yeah, absolutely. Do I have to?
It is part of the rules and part of your regulations and required job. So thanks for preparing.
I am prepared. I am prepared. I can do this. All right. So the cover, it has our heroes in the classic JLI upturned face pose against a white background. The difference this time, though, is that they are being viewed through a magnifying glass because as the image below the magnifying glass reveals, our heroes are teeny tiny itsy bitsy in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids fashion. Guy Gardner, never one to let being shrunken down to pea size quell his massive anger issues, is shouting in what I can only hear in my head as a high, squeaky voice, "What are you looking at?"
I hadn't even thought of that being at a high-pitched squeaky, but now I can't not. I love that. That's brilliant. Well done.
That's why I'm smarter than you, Shag.
Oh, is that what they call it? Okay, no. Fair enough. So what do you think of the cover?
In concept, I think this is a great variation of the now classic JLI group shot pose. I mean, they went back to this this picture again and again, did some great variations on it. I think this is the concept is one of the better ones because it's tied to the story. It's also, you know, it harkens back to the classic pose. It's good in concept.
This is actually the seventh time they've done it. So they did it Justice League number one, obviously. Justice League 24, when they brought in all the other members. Mm-hmm. Justice League Europe number one. They did Justice League Annual number four, which is the Antarctica team. Justice League Quarterly number one, which was the conglomerate team. Mm-hmm. And then Justice League Europe 26, which was just last month of, you know, in comparison to this, which was Starros. So seventh time now.
Wow. Did you actually go back and research all of that?
I have been doing this podcast for 6 years. I know it off the top of my head now.
What a sad and lonely life you must lead.
Says the man living with two cats named after superheroes, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, you're right. Touche. anyway, in execution, I think this kind of a cover, it becomes problematic if the artist isn't as adept at drawing faces as Kevin Maguire or can reach that level. Because, you know, Kevin Maguire, who nobody draws facial expressions better than he does.
Right.
This is an early work, I believe, of Mike McCone. This is, I don't know if it's one of his first works for DC, but this is definitely an earlier work.
He's been doing a few things for the Justice League book. Okay. Usually it's in this sort of capacity when it's like an extra, an annual or something like that.
Okay.
So, I mean, he's done a handful. But yeah, I would say it's definitely still early in his career. I mean, this is not the Mike McCone you're going to see later on, like, Teen Titans and stuff like that.
Sure, yeah. And I think he struggles here to put effective facial features on the characters. I'm just looking at them and, like, Fire isn't even looking up. She looks like she's looking at her breasts. Like most people would be. Okay.
Yeah, right.
I can't blame her for that. And it just, the facial expressions just aren't as vivid to me as like something. I mean, I hate to say, you know, compare him to Kevin Maguire, but if you're going to follow in Kevin Maguire's footsteps, you're going to invite that in comparison.
Yeah.
And so I do find that a little, it's not bad. I'm not saying this is horrible work. It just, you know, it's like, okay, the concept is great. The faces are meh, you know.
I would say about half of them are good. You know, like I'd say Captain Atom looks sharp. I'd say Guy Gardner looks pretty good, actually.
Yeah.
I'd say Flash looks pretty good. Ice and Silver Sorceress and actually all the women, I guess, kind of, and Blue Beetle are off. Yeah, I would agree with that. Absolutely. Which is unfortunate, but I don't think it's bad enough. Like, I've seen a lot of really bad artwork on comic books over the years.
Sure.
So I think this still holds up over a lot of other stuff that would have been on the shelves in 1991. You know, you think about the stuff Marvel's cranking out at this point, like all the comics. So I don't think it's awful at all.
It's definitely an eye-catching cover.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. You know, it's just like, for me, it's just like you were saying, some of the facial expressions and features are off.
Yeah. I agree. The word balloon's great. I love that it's not reflected in the magnifying glass. It's only, so it looks super tiny. I mean, and now that you said the squeakiness, it really reinforces the idea of the squeakiness, which is great. The white background really makes all of it pop. I mean, it really, really bounces off the white background. fantastically. And then this is something I just noticed seconds ago as you and I were getting ready to do this. And this is down to the colorist and the inker probably. But if you look on the edge of the magnifying glass, right above Silver Sorceress's little weird pointy ear things, you can actually see the reflection of the Justice League Quarterly logo, which is you see the blue bits and then the white dots and stuff like that.
Oh, okay.
So someone took the time to reflect the logo, which is that's actually pretty cool.
That is great. Okay.
So I think the cover's a lot of fun. Is it, all those previous ones I mentioned, I'm pretty sure, unless I'm mistaken, every single one of those was McGuire or Sears. So it's not up to that caliber, but it's still, I think it's a lot of fun. I like it.
Absolutely. Yeah. It enticed me to buy it on the stands when I saw it. Of course, I was buying everything Justice League anyway, but
exactly.
I remembered this cover, I'll put it to you that way, from many, many years ago. So it definitely stuck with me.
Yeah. So let's get inside this. So the plot and potentially breakdowns by Keith Giffen. Dialogue is by Gerard Jones. Penciler is Mike McCone. Inker is Bob Smith. Letter is John Costanza. Colorist is Gene D'Angelo. Assistant editor is Kevin Dooley. And editor is Andy Helfer. The issue itself is called When You Wish. And thankfully, Steve's not going to sing for us, but he is going to start us off on our recap. So off you go.
I actually have a very good singing voice.
That's nice. Read the recap, son.
Anyway. <all right. laughs> So our story opens. I do have a question. I'm sorry not to keep pausing here, but.
Oh, my God. The longest recording ever.
Yes, exactly. At this stage in the continuity, the Silver Sorceress, Mitch Wacky, and Blue Jay, are they from Angor or are they from an Earth-like planet? Planet that is an other dimensional world.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
At this point, Angor is another planet, very Earth-like, in a parallel dimension, because this is post-crisis, so we can have alternate Earths.
Yeah.
However, when they're there, you see American flags, you see New York City.
That's where I was getting confused.
It is clearly a parallel Earth, and they're just saying, oh, screw it, who cares? We'll just call it a parallel world, or a parallel dimension, and be done with it.
Okay, that I can roll with. I just wanted to make sure in my recap that I was properly attributing where everything is. Okay,
good.
All right, got it. So our story opens with Mitch Wacky visiting his home world, wherever that may be. As he stands among the city ruins, he remembers how the people of his world were killed by nuclear holocaust. His reverie is interrupted by his watch alarm in the shape of a mouse. Wonder who that could be, reminding him that it is time to go back to Earth. In the next scene, the JLI have gathered for a conference with tons of paparazzi gathered outside the New York embassy. Maxwell Lord reveals to Catherine Colbert that he has kept the conference a secret to stir up public interest. Max tries to flirt with Catherine, and she threatens to speak German at him, which I don't think Max, or most men for that matter, would see as a deterrent. I mean, just the opposite, as a matter of fact. When the woman is as hot as Catherine Colbert, I would be like, yeah, speak German at me, baby. Do what you need to. But whatever. Anyway. Then in a splash page featuring a superhero social gathering that would have Rob Kelly squealing like a Justin Bieber fan, the members of both JLI branches mingle together and interactions of varying degrees of humor take place. Of special note, you have General Glory comes across as the unintentionally racist uncle you try to avoid at family dinners. And the Flash gets encapsulated in a block of ice when his flirtations with ice go too far. The most crucial interaction, though, is between Mitch and Kilowog, who discover a common passion for inventing new technology. Kilowog takes Mitch down into his private lab, and this burgeoning bromance turns into a discussion about building a time machine. Kilowog, having obviously never seen the Back to the Future movies, is convinced that building and using a time machine is a good idea, because nothing has ever gone wrong in the DC universe when characters randomly start time traveling.
True that.
No. Mitch has decided he wants to go back in time while simultaneously traversing to his home dimension to save his planet. As Mitch and Kilowog leave, their departure is witnessed by the Silver Sorceress and Blue Beetle. The Sorceress, also a survivor from the same world as Mitch, deduces where he has gone and what he plans to do. He has gone back in time to prevent the nuclear accident that created the extremists, the supervillains who devastated their home planet with nuclear weapons to begin with. A team is gathered composed of Captain Atom, Blue Beetle, Flash, Fire, Ice, Power Girl, the Silver Sorceress, and Guy Gardner. This team has to follow Mitch and Kilowog to prevent them from tampering with the time stream, because nothing has ever gone wrong when multiple groups of people go time traveling and dimension hopping in the DC universe.
Also true.
Meanwhile, Mitch and Kilowog arrive in the past of the other dimensional world to find they have also been shrunken by the process. Kilowog surmises their diminutive state is due to the Imskian technology used to build the time machine, because the people of the planet Imsk are known to use shrinking technology for moving cargo and freight. And if you're one of those losers who are fans of the Legion of Superheroes, you will know that Imsk is the homeworld of Shrinking Violet. Undaunted. That was a joke, Shag.
Let me know when it starts to be funny.
Ha 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 ha.
Or we could have referenced the entire issue of Justice League that was all about the Imskins and shrinking and stuff like that. So that's where I'm leading.
Oh, got it. Okay. Undaunted, Mitch continues with his plan to contact the heroes of that era, who are a marvelous array of characters banded together to form that world's superhero team, the Justifiers. However, to reach out to the Justifiers, Mitch chooses a solution that would make Rube Goldberg blush. Rather than travel directly to the Justifiers' headquarters and try to reach out directly to the heroes, Mitch decides to spend time building a giant android of himself that he and Kilowog will quote-unquote pilot through the city streets. The android, built to look like Mitch, but actually looking like a cross between Colonel Sanders and 70-era's Stan Lee... is glitchy, to say the least. But Mitch and Kilowog manage to get to the Justifiers' headquarters and try to warn the heroes of the impending accident. Before Mitch can deliver the warning, however, the android disguise is discovered, and the Justifiers tear into it, believing they are under attack. As for the JLI team, who have followed Mitch and Kilowog, they also arrive shrunken down to size of fleas and make their way to the Justifiers' headquarters a moment too late. The Justifiers have destroyed the android. The JLI guess that Mitch and Kilowog have escaped and are still somewhere in the headquarters. And indeed they are. Mitch and Kilowog, we find out, have made their way into the computer circuitry network of the mansion. Mitch has altered his plan as he realizes the Justifiers will be of no help. But before Mitch fully explains his new plan, the two comrades are set upon by the dreaded Robo-Roaches, tiny security and cleaning robots in the walls of the headquarters. But don't get too excited, folks, because in a maneuver right out of Scooby-Doo, Mitch and Kilowog escape the roaches in just two panels. Panel one, Kilowog goes full tilt matador and distracts the roaches with his coat. Panel two, Mitch and Kilowog escape by just running underneath the Robo-Roaches.
I'll take it from here. So Mitch and Kilowog, they escape the Justifiers' headquarters by stealing and piloting the boot of the Iron Man analog character. Yes, you did hear me correctly. They pilot Iron Man's boot.
But of course they do.
Right. So they're heading for the nuclear testing facility, where an accident will soon create the dreaded extremists. Now, if they can stop the creation of the extremists, they just might save Angor. Meanwhile, our assembled teeny tiny JLI team is too late and watches the boot as it flies past them. Now we cut to the nuclear testing facility, which, by the way, the name of the facility is Timely. Very clever, like that. Where five criminals arrive with plans to steal a mega bomb. While the five are just regular humans, the astute reader will recognize these people as the people who will become transformed into the extremists. Mitch and Kilowog arrive at the facility, and now Mitch is panicked, and he desperately is trying to stop a technician from pressing a button that will activate the bomb. But in a shocking twist, and quite frankly, a heartbreaking twist, Mitch slips and falls, and he himself causes the accidental detonation that creates the extremists. So the very act of them traveling back in time to prevent the creation of the extremists is what actually created the extremists. So for you time travel fans, this is called a grandfather paradox. Or for you fans of the movie Time Rider, yeah, it's the same plot as where he went back in time and slept with a woman who turned out to be his own grandmother. Yeah, same thing. So the JLI contingent finally catch up with Mitch and Kilowog, and Silver Sorceress believes that she can use her magic to return their heroes to their own time and dimension. She successfully transports everyone back to Earth, but in the wrong decade. They're about 12 years in the past, and they're still teeny tiny. The only place the heroes can think of to gather enough advanced electronics to create another time machine is at the Justice League headquarters. And here is where the adventure really hits the reader in the feels. The League of Lilliputians arrive at the Secret Sanctuary cave to witness one of the earliest meetings of the founding Justice League of America. We're talking about Martian Manhunter, Green Lantern Hal Jordan, Aquaman, Black Canary, and Flash Barry Allen, who, of course, is Wally's mentor. And, of course, Barry's now deceased at this point. He gets better, but not at this point. Wally desperately wants to go and visit with Barry, but Captain Atom convinces Wally it's too risky to the timeline. So our modern JLI heroes, they crawl and they fly all around the gathering components they need amid some, honestly, some pretty funny gags, such as Guy Gardner intentionally dropping components on Hal Jordan's head, and then us overhearing Black Canary debating costume choices of between visible panty lines versus wearing no underwear at all. Yeah, that conversation actually happens. So good news, the impromptu time machine works, and our heroes are transported back to the JLI embassy in the proper time. Unfortunately, they've been shrunk even further, and now each of them are not much bigger than a flea. So after a long trek up the stairs from the basement, they grab a ride on Liberty the dog. Unfortunately, Power Girl's cat attacks Liberty the dog, creating havoc. So Catherine Colbert intercedes, rescuing the dog, and Captain Atom gets her attention by screaming in her ear. Later, after our heroes have returned to full size, Kilowog is reprimanded by Max for assisting with the time travel shenanigans. Max also says they need to keep an eye on the depressed Mitch, so they offer him a job as a JLI handyman. In the end, Silver Sorceress and Blue Jay share their grief and agree to make this Earth their own, while Wally spends some time on his own thinking about his lost mentor, Barry. And as the issue ends, we're spending the time with Elrond and Oberon that are watching over Liberty the dog. Because you see, earlier, Liberty swallowed the teeny tiny Guy Gardner, and Guy is the only leaguer unaccounted for. That means they have to wait for the teeny tiny Guy Gardner to be expelled from Liberty the dog's body the natural way. Yes, exactly what you're thinking. So next issue,
give that dog a bran muffin.
Next issue, the diabolical return of the Injustice League. Whew. All right, so that is 80 pages of comedy genius. Why don't you start us off, Steve? What'd you think?
Well, you know, you say comedy genius, but for all the humor, this story has a surprisingly darker tone compared to other JLI stories, which I think was a hallmark of the quarterly series. I always felt like the quarterly series had, for lack of a better way of putting it, more serious stories.
Hmm. Yeah, well, it's like I said, though, a lot of times they use the humor mm-hmm. to really, really make the emotional bits punch more. So, yeah, the fact of Mitch ending up causing the destruction of his own world by the very fact that he went back in time mm-hmm. to try and stop that destruction, it is absolutely heartbreaking. I mean, I genuinely feel bad for him.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and the humor doesn't detract from that, which is something I felt I really appreciated. Like, there's definitely funny moments in here, but they were never at the detriment to the story of Mitch having this experience.
Yeah. Know? I mean, Giffen's really great at crafting that. Without a doubt.
Absolutely. Mike McCone's art, there are some moments here where he really shines, and mm-hmm. there are some moments that I think are a little off. There are moments I love the panel of the Flash trapped in the ice cube with ice walking away reflected in the cube.
Right.
Really coolly done. And I think his depiction of the extremists is very effective.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's the panels of all the extremists just facing out to the reader.
Yeah, they've all been heavily irradiated and stuff. Yeah.
Well, after they became the extremists, I mean, his depiction of them after they became.
Oh, the flashback. Okay. Yeah.
But also in that moment where you're talking about, after they've been irradiated, they'd look like something out of Hellraiser.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's
fair.
Really well done.
Yeah.
But there were, like, I'm not gonna nitpick all the other stuff, but there were some things I was like, ugh, I seemed to not be pulled off as effectively as some of the other moments.
Yeah, there's some faces, without a doubt. Yeah. There's some faces that are off. Yeah. There's some body language here and there. But
yeah.
Let's take a second to talk about the group party. Let's talk about the one you said that make Rob Kelly squeal with delight. That's a great moment.
It is. It is. There's a lot going on there. You know, you got people who are, you know, you go read through it. And like, and that's where I said there's varying degrees of humor.
Sure.
Well, there's some potty humor in this scene. And there's also that moment that I mentioned earlier about General Glory. I don't think at the time I read it, I appreciated it, especially like in today's political climate. When I read that, I was like, that sounds like every casually racist uncle I've ever encountered at family dinners.
Yeah. Now, I want to point out, this is the first time, the very first time, General Glory's dialogue has been written by someone other than J.M. DeMatteis. And that may be what we're seeing here, is that J.M. DeMatteis always made General Glory, you know, a little goofy, right? You know,
yeah.
But he was always true-hearted, and he was always someone, you no matter what, you liked. Mm-hmm. And so I think this may be a reflection on someone else trying to emulate that and maybe missing the mark.
Got it.
I want to talk about that group shot because I love it so much. There's some great stuff in it. Like, I really love that they took the time to think out the pairings of who mm-hmm. would be talking to each other. Like, you've got Max and Catherine talking because, you know, they're the bosses, right, of their own individual leagues. You've got John Jones and Captain Atom talking. You know, they're the field leaders of each team. You've got Batman and Crimson Fox talking because they're cut very much of the same cloth. I mean, they're both, you know, the whole super rich person who, you know, dresses up. In fact, she met him in her first appearance.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yep. You've got the Blue and the Gold talking with Rocket Red. These are former teammates reunited, right? You've got Oberon and Elrond talking because they're both kind of the admins of the league. You've got General Glory and Mr. Miracle talking, and they're both brand new additions to the team, even though they've got Mr. Miracle drawn on the wrong costume. This is supposed to be Shiloh, but they've got him in Scott Free's costume. That's just a mistake. But then you've got Kilowog, Sue, and Mitch talking as well, and they're all support people. So, I mean, it's really clever the way they structured this, and it is very reminiscent of the old, you know, satellite era parties between the JSA and the JLA. It feels very much like that.
And, you know, and speaking of the supporting characters or the support people, which was actually their roles in the embassies, in this story, I really enjoyed the budding friendship between Mitch and Kilowog. Like, mm-hmm. I would have read further adventures of them, like what crazy shenanigans are they going to get up to now?
Yeah,
you know, I think they, for whatever reason, they just worked well together. And hallmark of all these JLI books, something I've always liked about them was the attention and development they always gave to the secondary characters. They always had really memorable characters, like Catherine Colbert, and, you know, and Sue Dibney was always used very well in the book. I really appreciated that aspect of it.
They knew what they had with the characters that didn't headline their own books. That, you know, these characters, they said, okay, you know, Fire and Ice are the best examples. These are characters that live here, and we can develop them any which way we want. And so they could take an existing character like Fire and Ice, or they could take a character they made up themselves like Catherine Colbert and just really, really spend a lot of time with them and make them into characters that you knew, that you genuinely felt like you knew and understood. Yeah, they're great mm-hmm. at it.
Absolutely.
So I got a couple more art things I want to mention, just ones that made me scratch my head in the party scene. As much as I love the party scene, I mentioned, you know, Shiloh's in the wrong uniform. There's also two other things. One is Booster Gold's there, which I can explain it away. He just came for the party, but he's not on the team anymore. You know, so he's on the conglomerate. So maybe he just came to hang out and have fun, which would be totally understandable. But the one that I do struggle with is Elongated Man has transformed into a couch or a bench. Silver Sorceress and Fire are both sitting on it, which I'm sure he's thrilled with. And so is Metamorpho, maybe not so thrilled about that. But that's not his power. He doesn't transform into things. Like, he stretches and stuff like that, but that's Plastic Man's gig, where he, you know, transforming into benches and stuff. So that had me kind of scratching my head, like, oh, kind of missed the mark on that one.
I've got two comments for that. One, I remember the anniversary issue of Detective Comics mm-hmm. that came out. It was Batman teams up with an old Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
And Elongated Man is in that one. And he is on a rocket. He's trying to stop a rocket. And I remember him stretching out his fingers and turning them into tools for him to use. So, typically he was never depicted as shape-shifting the way that Plastic Man would. But there is comic book precedence for him shape-shifting like that. With that said, yeah, it is kind of like, oh, you don't typically see him doing things like that. But I figured it was a party scene. Maybe he'd had a little bit too much to drink and he was just all loosey-goosey and able to form himself into a bench. Especially since isn't Fire sitting on the bench?
Yeah, Fire and Silver Sorcerer is both. both. So he's probably pretty excited about that.
Yeah, I would contort myself into a bench if fire was going to sit on me.
So let's talk about the Justifiers, you know, the equivalent, essentially the Marvel Avengers in the DC universe. So what'd you think of them?
I thought they were a really nice send-up of the Marvel characters, you know, especially in how angsty and, you know, self-involved they are.
Yeah. You know?
Just all of them had like these personal issues, and they were like, my personal issues are worse than yours. Like, right. They were just like, I'm like, okay, if that's definitely Marvel at its worst.
That's a very good summation of those pages. And obviously it was very on purpose. It was very funny. Mm-hmm. Now, we've met these characters before, going all the way back to Justice League of America, issue number 87, which was a zillion years ago in the 70s. And there we met Juan Jinnah, which was Thor, Silver Sorceress, which is Scarlet Witch, Blue Jay, which is Yellow Jacket, and Captain Speed, which is Quicksilver. But here they introduce some more. We get to meet Tin Man, which is a funny send-up of Iron Man, except he's like really big and bulky, which is funny. We see there's an Archer, I don't think they gave a name to, who's obviously very much like Hawkeye. You get a giant guy who's very much like Giant Man and Goliath. And then you get a woman who's all in green, who is either, she's got to be Moon Dragon based on her costume. I guess she could be Wasp. I'm not sure. Did you mention that there is a name for her in the comics?
In looking this up, because I was trying to figure out, like, what is the actual history of these characters? She's listed as being named T.A.
Oh, my Lord.
Capital T, capital A. And I'm like, okay, it's Giffen and DeMatteis. I know what they were going for here.
I mean, basically, guys, she's wearing a costume that would make Phantom Lady blush. So pretty much. Also, around in the Marvelous universe, we saw like a Wolverine character, but he had like mouse ears. And he was fighting a guy clearly based on Marvel's Sonic character, Claw. We saw another Iron Man-like guy. And there's like a group shot. And they didn't give us any names, but I'm guessing that that's probably a Spider-Man, a Punisher, a Cyclops, and some like big dude. I don't know. So we got to see lots of different Marvel characters through this lens, and I just find it a hoot. I think it's a blast. I love just those few moments of all the angst. It was super fun. I like that when the Justice League is at the Justifiers headquarters, there's a butler who's essentially Jarvis, right? And Beetle is outraged that this team has a butler and the JLI doesn't, which just cracks me up. I thought that was hilarious.
Well, now, you know what cracked me up about the butler was he was the only normal, smart one in the group.
True. Yeah. That's very true.
He's the one who actually figures out that the Mitch android is an android.
Okay. That android plot, like... Yeah. you know, the beauty of this comic is there's a joke on every page, and that is why it works, because some of them aren't going to work, and no. Mitch the robot just didn't work. It looks like he's, you know, he's clearly doing the Monty Python silly walk stuff, but it wasn't funny for me. But the rest of the issues were
really
hilarious. Yeah,
it wasn't funny. Are you kidding me?
Mitch the robot?
Oh my gosh, I thought it was hysterical.
Oh, okay. Well, see, that there you go. Perfect. See, that's a perfect example of why humor works, you know, for some people, not for others. Some people have a sense of humor like myself, and there's people like you who just like dumb fart jokes. So there we go. That's perfect.
No, I can explain why I think it's funny, but I don't know if you would understand it, Shag.
Explaining jokes always works so well.
No, it provides a moment where the two groups who are seeking each other out intersect with each other and don't realize it. And I always find that funny.
Well, the misunderstanding was cute, yes. But yeah, like, yeah, that's fine.
And I think it really is a great way of punching up how like self-involved and stupid the Justifiers are, because Mitch shows up. He's clearly, something is wrong with him.
Right.
And they're just like, oh, can I get your autograph? Or, you know, oh, is he having a stroke? What's going on? You know, they're completely oblivious. I'm like, no wonder your world was destroyed by nuclear holocaust, because you're dumb. You know?
Well, they immediately leap to a fight as well, which is perfect for the Marvel style, which is great. So I do wonder if this is just Keith Giffen like desperately wanting to write some Marvel comics, or just, you know, or picking on the competition. I don't know which, but either way, it's a lot of fun.
It is, absolutely.
Now, we talked about some of Mike McCone's weaknesses. I want to talk about some of his strengths. Drawing technology, he is, at this point in career, he is exceptional at it. Like,
yes,
whether it's architecture or like there's a scene on page 34 where he's got Guy Gardner's using his ring to create devices to help transport some of the league, and Flash and Silver Sorceress are on this giant like flying Harley Davidson kind of thing, and Ice and Blue Beetle are on another one that's more like, I don't know, a cool scooter kind of thing. But the technology is so detailed and really, really, like, even to the point where, I don't know if you noticed on the license plate, one of them says Guy and one of them says says ICE.
That's funny.
One of them has a little tiny pennant flag. I mean, he's really gone to an amazing amount of detail in these things.
Yeah, his backgrounds, especially when he's, like you're saying, drawing technology, it looks wonderful. I mean, even like the time machine that they hobble together at the end, the detail on it is amazing. And yeah, I totally agree with that.
Yeah.
As I say it, I'm choking on the words as I say them.
That's okay. So, you know, leaving the Justifier world for a second here and going to Earth of the Past. Wow. Okay. So that was super powerful. Super powerful. Seeing the modern day League running around with the classic era League. I mean, did you get the feels like I did, or is it just me?
Yeah, definitely. And this was because I'm a Flash fan, as you can tell by what I named my my cat. And specifically, I'm a Wally West fan. So I was also reading Flash at the time.
I thought you named your cat after what your first restraining order was based on. Okay.
No, that was something else. But yeah, that moment, you know, it was the first time actually in the Justice League books where Wally wasn't just a, you know, crazy horn dog.
Right.
And I was like, okay, so they are paying attention to what's going on in the Flash books. And part of the reason that this book stands out to me is because of that moment with the Flash.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was definitely there. And I, not only was it in character for Wally to react the way he did, but it was really cool, like the pep talk he gets from Captain Atom, like telling him that, you know, you need to step up from this, you know, you let the past be the past, and you're really, you know, you're everything that Barry was, you know, you've really got it, what you need to do to be a great hero, kid. You know, kind of like that, that pep talk from a father figure that he needed to have.
Right.
Yeah.
And they've never had a good relationship. So it's even more meaningful that it's coming from Captain Atom to Wally.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, unless I'm mistaken, I'm pretty sure this is the very first time that Wally has been in the same room as Barry since his death in Crisis on Infinite Earths. Now Barry had shown up. Yeah. Barry had shown up a whole bunch in flashbacks and stuff like that. But Wally and Barry hadn't been in the same room. Now, once Mark Raid starts writing The Flash, they find reasons to bring Barry back every third week.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure this is the very first time. And so that's got to be even more meaningful for Wally to be like, oh my gosh, you know, this here it is. Here it is, you know?
Yeah. Wow, that's awesome. I hadn't thought of that.
There was another nice little moment, too, where after Captain Atom, you know, gives him that pep talk, there's just this one single panel where they focus over to Blue Beetle, and he's saying that he's trying to imagine himself in Wally's shoes if it was Dan Garrett in the other room. It's like, wow, I hadn't even thought about that. You know, wow, okay. Again, powerful stuff. And the complete flip side of that is, you know, Guy Gardner being a dick, dropping electronics on purpose on Hal Jordan's head, which is hilarious.
No, yeah. But, you know, what else is Guy Gardner going to be?
Right.
You know, what else is he going to do?
Yeah. I got to say, these issues, did you ever read JLA Year One?
Yeah, I did. Yes.
I love that series. It's absolutely exceptional.
It's a wonderful book. Absolutely.
And even though this thing was published years before Year One, it feels like it fits seamlessly in there. I mean, all the JLAers are perfectly in character. Mike McCohen's attention to detail, it doesn't look like Barry Kitson's, but there's almost enough of a Barry Kitson fine line that it's like, okay, you could fool someone to thinking this was done after JLA Year One.
Sure.
It kind of has that vibe. Like, there's some casual conversations, like, you know, in JLA Year One, there's this great conversation between Flash and Black Canary, where Flash is making fun of her costume, and she grabs his cowl and spins it, right?
Yeah, that's one of my favorite panels from that book.
But, oh, it's hilarious.
Yeah.
Well, here, there's this sort of a parallel piece where Black Canary herself is talking about costumes. She's specifically talking about having to deal with visible panty lines and how it ruins the whole look of her costume. And then she says, you know, the alternative is wearing nothing underneath her costume. It's hysterical, because these are the kind of conversations people in costumes would actually have. Now, and also, if you're not really paying attention, you miss what she's talking about, because she doesn't say visible panty lines. She says VPL, which I had to Google. And I'm like, what is VPL? I'm like, oh my gosh. You know, that's what's going on in this conversation. Holy, because it's like in the background. It's not really the focus of what's going on. It's like in a montage. So that bit just cracks me up.
It's out of curiosity, what kind of visuals popped up when you looked up VPL?
Thankfully, it was just all text from what I was getting.
Oh, got it.
Speaking of art, by the way, going back just a couple of pages, page 52, mm-hmm. and this is just a weird thing I noticed while I was reading it, they actually got a couple of panels out of order.
Mm-hmm.
There's a panel where they're asking Kilowog if he can make a time machine, and Kilowog's saying, well, yeah, if you can find some really, you know, advanced technology. Well, the panels are actually reversed, so when you read it, you're like, you're kind of like, what's happening here? And then once you realize they're out of order, it's like, oh, okay. So I don't know. That doesn't happen too often, so it jumped out at me.
I don't remember noticing that at the time. Was it published like that?
Yeah, I pulled up my physical copy, okay. and I'm reading my copy from Comixology. So okay. Yeah.
I must not have been as astute a reader as I thought I was at 16.
Or at 65, like you are now. So.
I mean, when I read it through this time for the show, I was like, wait a minute, something doesn't jive here. And then you made a note about it. I was like, oh, okay, it must be an obvious thing if Shag picked up on it.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yep. Yeah. Now, I got a question for you. Or maybe you can help me figure this out because I can't. On page 59, there's a great chart. You talked about the technology that Mike McCone's drawn for the time machine. It does look great. But all the characters are there. They're all kind of having fun, like Blue Beetle's kicking his feet up and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Fire is clearly doing something to Captain Atom with her elbow. Mm-hmm. I can't tell if she's elbowing him, if she's flirting with him, if she's mocking him. I don't know what's going on there. I don't know. Am I missing something?
You know, it looks like she's just posing and looking down at Blue Beetle, who is... The better question is, what the hell is Blue Beetle doing?
He's having fun.
sticking his feet up in the air like that. But it looks like she's just striking a glamour girl pose.
Okay. Well, since Captain Atom was looking at her and he's got his hand out, I thought he was, you know, being like, hey, knock it off. But I'm not sure. It's also nice to see Silver Sorceress comforting Mitch, which is very sweet, given their relationship absolutely. And where they're both mm-hmm. from. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. nice. Also, a couple pages after that, we actually see Blue Beetle's BB gun, which you almost never see in the JLI, which is exciting to me.
Is that the air compression gun you're talking about?
Yeah, like it shoots a blast of air or it shoots a blinding light. So you never see him with it in this thing, even though he used it all the time in his own series. So
absolutely. Yeah, cool.
And then there's I know you want to talk about this. There's this bit where Catherine Colbert breaks up the fight between Liberty and I'm pretty sure the cat's name is Stinky. We'll just call him Stinky the Cat. And she's cuddling the dog, saying, oh, you poor dog. And in French, she's being like calling the cat a monster and a devil and things like that. And she's saying, poor baby to the dog. And she's trying, you know, did the evil kitty hurt that little puppy? Personally, I liked that. I liked that Power Girl's outraged. She's like, I thought Catherine liked my cat, you know, so I found that pretty funny.
Well, you know what? I was funny. The sequence was funny. And I thought that I'm perfectly fine with Catherine having a preference for dogs over cats. There are people who are right, like me, who love cats. And there are people who are wrong, who love dogs. I will say this, that she lost a little bit of attractiveness to me in that panel on page 66 and how she's picking the cat up by the scruff of its neck. I was like, oh, no, you don't pick up an animal like that.
Well, I think she's doing it because the cat is viciously attacking. The cat's claws are out and there is growling and has been biting and slashing the dog. I think that's the only way she felt she could do it safely.
But look at her face. She totally is like, she's not afraid for her life or anything like that. She's just angry and picking the cat up. I'm like, nah, you don't pick an animal up like that.
All right. That's
true. That's just my bleeding heart animal cat lover coming out in me.
That's fair.
I imagine it was Flash or Nightwing and I would break my heart in two.
I understand. So I will take the other side, by the way, and say I was a cat person for some 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And after going through several heartbreaks and having cat-shaped holes in my heart, we now have a dog. And I discovered I am a dog person now. So
very good.
You can grow and change and be better, Steve.
That's true. I will say this. Some of us can grow and change and be better, Shag. I still have hopes for you whenever that happens. But now that my cats are not within hearing distance, I will say that I do love dogs. Aww. I do appreciate dogs. It's just cats are, you know, they have more personality and they're more low maintenance.
By low maintenance, yeah. If you mean high maintenance, then yes, you're absolutely correct. So going forward a few pages later, you get a great shot of Mitch where he's being, you know, in trouble with Max. But thanks to the beauty of panel by panel mode, I was able to get a good look at Mitch's tie. And his tie has the Fantastic Four logo. It has webs for Spider-Man. It has Captain America's shield. It's got Thor's hammer. It's got, I think, the X-Men symbol in there, too.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
It's awesome. It's perfectly representative of the Marvel Universe because he's from there. And here's the crazy thing. By sheer coincidence, this is the exact same tie I wore to Rob Kelly's wedding. So, I mean, that's nuts. You were there. You saw it. So you can vouch for me.
Yes, it was as subtle as a train wreck.
I have heard that phrase a few times in my life. So, big picture, I thought this issue was a lot of fun. I wasn't sure going in what to think. You know, like I didn't have any memory of this story whatsoever. I did get contacted by some former guests who said how much they loved this issue and they absolutely adored it. And so I was like, okay, well, you know, if they like it, then I guess it's got to be good. And yeah, I really did have a lot of fun. The first day I read it, I was sick as a dog. And so I didn't really get as much mileage out of the humor because I was just so sick. But then, you know, when you do these things for a podcast, you have to read these things like two or three times. And so as I read it again, I'm like, you know, this is genuinely funny. Like, is this the kind of comic you feel like you got your laugh's worth? You know, because again, it's three times the cost of a normal issue. What'd you think?
Well, here's the thing. When you asked me to be on the show, I think you gave me a choice between this issue and something else. And when I saw that you wanted me to, one of my choices was doing this issue, this is the one I leapt at because I remembered this story. I'm with those fans who have reached out to you and said that they remember the story and they loved it. I knew this one. And I, you know, I knew what the beats were. I remembered some of the images. I remembered this story from having read it 30 some odd years ago. And like I said, I literally had not read it for 30 years until you asked me to do the show again. But this story has stuck with me for that long. And so I think that says something about it. And it, you know, it's, as far as you said, it give me my laugh's worth. Well, the story has funny moments, but I appreciated more how they were able to work in the more serious stuff without letting the humor to take away from that.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. So overall, I think it's a win. You know, I really do feel like whether you walk away with a yuck or you walk away with the emotional bits there, I think it's a great package all the way together. And I mean, the humor comes from the shrinking is what it boils down to. That's where the gags work. Yes. Is the fact that the league is so small, the whole issue, which is freaking hysterical. And here's something that I didn't even think about till getting ready for this is there's a piece of the perspective that we've lost now that we're 30 on years later, which is this issue came out 2 years after Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
Oh,
which,
yeah.
You know, if you're having too much distance from it, you're probably thinking, well, okay, it was a movie, Rick Moranis, whatever. I was shocked in going back and researching it again that this was a super unexpected box office explosion. Mm-hmm. It was Disney's highest grossing live action film of all time at that point. And it held that record for 5 years, which is crazy, which also explains why they built the whole Honey, I Shrunk the Kids like playground, you know, at Disney MGM Studios and all that. But yeah, that movie was huge to the point where they kept making sequels and TV series and everything else. So that was very much in the zeitgeist when this issue was done. So there's a lot of that going on that, you know, here, again, 30 years later, we weren't even thinking about.
Yeah. And well, I don't remember at the time Honey, I Shrunk the Kids, like factoring into my reading of the book. But yeah, everything that you just said definitely fits and makes sense that that would be part of the cultural fabric. Yeah.
The part where you said everything you said makes sense, you should just put that on a loop and play that as you go to sleep at night. So. All right. So, folks, again, I think this issue is fun. If you haven't read it, I highly recommend you dig it out and give it a read again, because now we have to get to one of the most difficult things of the episode, which is where we have to nominate the
Pwahaha Award.
This is where we nominate the funniest moment of the issue. Both myself and Steve will pick one moment, and only one will be awarded the coveted Pwahaha Award. Now, Steve, in an issue where there's a joke on pretty much every page, if not multiple jokes, where are you going with this?
Well, you know what? There's a lot of visual humor. There's a lot of really great moments. I've got to go with General Glory coming across as your racist uncle.
Oh my gosh.
I know that was out of character for him, but I'm like, that was actually pretty well written. I responded to that.
You responded to racist uncles. Okay, I get it.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Well, the other moment was the Mitch Wacky android, but we've already talked about that, and I know how you feel about that.
That ain't getting my vote. No. You know, on the General Glory thing, I got to say, it took me a minute to understand one of the things he was saying. Because he's talking to Rocket Red, because that's where all this comes from. It's kind of fun because you get America and the Soviet Union up against each other. Because he's basically trying to, you know, give a pep speech to Rocket Red. And he's saying, let me tell you, Dimitri, it does this old heart good to see this Perry Stroker business in action. And I'm like, what the heck is he talking about? And then I had to remember, what's the actual Russian term?
Perestroika.
Perestroika, right, exactly. So like, that's what he's trying to say. Oh my gosh.
Instead, it sounds like something that's really dirty.
Oh goodness, wow, you had to go there. Okay, wow, all right. So those are that's your pick, huh? General Glory. All right. Mm-hmm. Well, my pick was a little bit different. I wanted to pick a funny moment also that was what I felt like was the core of the story, which is back in the past in the Justice League Secret Sanctuary cave. So I went with the montage of scenes where you're hearing the classic League talk and the modern day League are doing funny things like Captain Adams flying stuff. You know, they're sneaking parts past. That's the part where Black Canary makes the joke about visible panty lines. It's the part where Guy Gardner drops the spark plug or something on Hal Jordan's head. Like that, I found that sort of funny and endearing and felt like that was the award winner for me. Now we have to decide, is it the heartwarming look back at a classic era of heroes or is it your racist uncle? So I don't know. I don't know which way you might want to go, Steve. You tell me.
For a visual sense, Shag, I will concede that moment you came up with is visually funnier.
You're just thinking about the visible panty lines. I know.
I am. And but in terms of landing humor that lands, for me, it was the General Glory, you know, Perry Stroker thing. Yeah.
All right, great. Now you're talking on both sides of your mouth. So do you have a...
Do I have a favorite? I'm you know what? I'm going to be kind. And as a guest of the show, I'm going to say that while in my heart, mine's funnier, I'm going to say that I'll concede and say that your moment of the shenanigans is funnier.
There we go. Perfect. Yeah. And this network is founded on the Firewater podcast, which is all about Aquaman and Firestorm. And there are a couple of Aquaman jokes on these pages where Aquaman's joking about he's hoping the shower works now. So yes, congratulations to the classic Justice League of America. America members, the founding members of the post-crisis era of the Justice League, you have won the coveted Bwahaha Award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as the laughter we give you. Now, Steve, I need to ask a favor, if you don't mind. Given your expertise in wrangling superhero-themed pets, would you mind hanging out here and handling Liberty the dog and Power Girl's cat? I'm kind of afraid they might wreck the embassy if left to their own devices.
Oh, yeah, don't worry. I knew where I was coming, so I brought along plenty of disinfectant and Febreze. I've also got some cat treats and a laser pointer, so PG's cat and I will be fine, and I'll put Liberty outside where he belongs.
Oh my gosh, it's like the ending of the Flintstones. Except I think that was it. He put the cat out. Anyway, doesn't matter. So and now you understand why in the beginning you asked why the embassy was such a mess and smelled so bad. That would be Liberty and the cat. So... thank you very much, Steve. I appreciate you babysitting the pets. And don't worry, we will bring you back at the end of the show. And while he's taking care of that for us, folks, we're going to do a podcast promo break. And when we come back, I'm going to read your listener feedback.
Saturn, who's there?
Hyperion to a Saturn.
Follow Siskoid's deep scene-by-scene dive into adaptations of Shakespeare's Hamlet on Hyperion to a Satyr, the Fire and Water Network's Hamlet podcast. To listen or not to listen isn't the question, as you well know. Kenneth Branagh, Derek Jacobi, Mel Gibson, Laurence Olivier, Ethan Hawke, David Tennant, Classics Illustrated, and many more covered every episode at fireandwaterpodcast.com or where you usually get your podcasts.
Is silent.
The Justice League wouldn't help him, so Batman formed a new team. They are the Outsiders.
We are the Outsiders! Oh, we are the Outsiders!
Covering Mike W. Barr's series into its third year, where change is in the air. A new member joins, an original member leaves, old and new threats, and the deadliest man alive. Oh, and more puns. The Outcasters is a Batman and the Outsiders podcast. Look for us under the Right On Network. That's WRIGHT on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. Or listen at our website, thehuntresspodcast.com, and follow us on Twitter at BatOutcasters. Join the Outcasters. Because to live outside the law, you must be honest.
Justice Log.
All right, folks, if you are listening to this prior to November 10th, head over to Kickstarter and look for De Multiverse. JM DeMatteis is launching four new comics co-created by folks like Tom Mandrake, Sean McManus, Matthew Dowsmith, and David Baldion. They're covering superhero genre, fantasy genre, western genre, more. It looks absolutely amazing. I've already backed the program. I really think you guys should as well. Again, go out to Kickstarter and look for De Multiverse and support JM DeMatteis and his newest effort. All right, now we want to hear your thoughts on this issue. Go out on social media. Use our hashtag FWPodcast. Remember, tag us at JLIPodcast, as I always say. It is about building a community of online fans around this show. All right, we are going to be pulling your comments from our website, email, social media, things like that. Just pulling bits and pieces because we've got a lot to cover. And we're actually talking about two different episodes. We're going to be talking about the episode that covered the 1987 role-playing module entitled When a Stranger Calls, which I recorded with Siskoid. And then the episode featuring JLA number 50 with my guest Captain Entropy and JLE number 26 with my guest JT the Exterminator. All right, first up, David Gallagher, professional comic book and video game writer, commented about the role-playing module stuff. He goes, I am here for this. Yeah, David. He's a huge fan of role-playing games, a great buddy of mine, and a good friend of the show. And David, I was there for that too, loving the DC Hero stuff. Then we're from Rob McCarthy from the Hell on Wheels webcomic, where he's talking about the role-playing module. We talked a lot about magic in role-playing games. And he says, only superhero stories make magic as powerful as magic in superhero stories. It's a little roundabout logic, but it makes sense. Because think about vampires, really. I mean, they're powerful right until 6 a.m., or if they fall in water or eat garlic. Or leprechauns are really, really powerful until you catch them. But in superhero comics in the 1940s, if you're a magic character, nobody cared enough to make rules for you, and you were pretty invincible. Yeah, all good points, Rob. All good points. Then we're from our buddy Gus Casals from the Argentina Embassy. He does shows such as Alfred Pennyworth Presents podcast and the Legion 60 Years Later podcast. He says, closing thoughts on General Glory. Yes, this arc is much better than I remembered. What I do think now, in hindsight, is that back then I could not really read the heart and pathos behind the General, Ernie, and yes, even Guy Gardner. I believe that still thinking as a teenager, well, I was 22, shut up. he says, while I was still thinking as a teenager, the JLI had gone from smart funny to silly funny. Then he says, my bad, my worst. Then Gus goes on to say, now, the meat of the issue, the Kyle Baker story. Guys, I loved it then, I love it now, and it made me a lifelong Baker fan, and I did go out and pick up Why I Hate Saturn. Besides being extremely funny, the art is gorgeous, and the inside jokes and characterization, boy, even if you're not familiar with Baba, if you have read Dr. Fate, you're familiar with DeMatteis' spiritual slant and the look as drawn by McManus, and man, Crazy Keith! As for the Justice League Europe cover, which I love for all the stated reasons, at the time I made color photocopies of all six covers and held them up in my bedroom wall. And the issue I love, even agreeing with the flaws you found. I remember feeling that the explosion was an actual gasp moment. Yeah, Gus, thank you so much for all that feedback. And yeah, that Kyle Baker story is insanely funny. And the Jay Lee stuff, man, that comic was firing on all thrusters at that point. Then we're from Bucky749, aka the American Samurai, who's got their own YouTube channel. Bucky says, regarding the role-playing game, he says, I listened to the live play, meaning the last time we did a Hero Points episode, you guys did, and it was great that Chris Franklin really channeled Adam West doing his speech on the show. And whoever was playing Firestorm, both guys certainly showed some talent, let me tell you. Well, Bucky, thank you, as I was one of those people playing Firestorm. And then regarding the Justice League issues, he says, salute to both the Captain Entropy and General Glory, and JT the Exterminator and the Captain did a great job. Well, thank you so much. Really appreciate it, Bucky. Then we heard from Symbol Pending from our UK embassy and their own Symbol Pending Power Girl blog. Symbol Pending says, I think Captain Entropy hit on something that bothered me about the JLA stories, and the JLE to be fair, with the comment about competent professionals goofing around in the off hours. Now, I love a good comic book soap as much as, if not more, than the next guy, but the problem is because they do so little heroing, a lot of their competency is implied. Which is ironic because both the JLA and the JLE, we get to see them showing off some superheroics and just basically doing stuff. Then they go on to say, it might be my imagination, but as well, I noticed a little more Blue Jay. Silver Surfer seemed to be more present than in the previous issues, and I still kind of think Starro is the innocent here, not having read ahead, but maybe it's because the, quote, curse your sudden and inevitable betrayal is such an overplayed trope even at this point. You know, Simple Pending, great points all the way around. Yes, I am noticing a little more Blue Jay, a little more Silver Sorceress. Not a lot, but I am seeing more. At this point, I have not read ahead either, so as far as I know, Starro may be the innocent party. Probably not, given that it's an evil starfish from space, and their last name is The Conqueror. But you know what? At this point, it would be interesting if they were innocent. Then we heard from Liz Ann Oswald. She says, the cover's fine for Justice League number 50, though it sadly does not really seem to work as well as it could. Electrically shocking the heroes is kind of cool. And Blue Beetle looks kind of like Rob Kelly was told he had to read a trade paperback out of Legion of Superheroes and review it for a weekly podcast. Oh, that's awesome. And then Liz says, the JSA working alongside with General Glory to defeat the villain in that flashback panel was kind of cool. Sadly, the General never made an appearance in Batman Brave and the Bold. I think he would have fit in well. You know, that's a great observation. General Glory would have been great in the Batman Brave and the Bold cartoon. Good thought. Then we're from Doug Adamson from our Scottish embassy regarding the role-playing game episode. He says, I never actually role-played. My wife used to play D&D, though, and my kids and I were trying to convince her to GM for us to try it out. But now I wonder if an on-the-rails type setup might work better for us. You know, Doug, on-the-rails stories work really, really great for when you don't have a lot of time to invest into how to build your own adventure. I'm doing a lot of Marvel stuff right now, and I use pre-made on-the-rails adventures because it just helps get it done. And you're able to improv enough to make it fun for everyone. And then Doug said, a very entertaining and educational episode. Thank you. Huh, you're welcome, Doug. Then regarding Justice League number 50 and Jay Lee number 26, he says, the guests of this episode were comedic gold. The joke about the Publix ice cream and the revelation that we ended up in an actual comic book character on the show in Starro honestly caused me to laugh out loud again. Oh, I'm glad, Doug. That's great. And he says, as to our Starro issue with Justice League Europe's Bart Sears cover is fantastic, and I do love the facehugger version of Starro. I, too, was shocked at the history of the Starro like Shag, was convinced that Starro had far more appearances than he actually did. Yeah, I'm still boggled that Starro was not more prevalent in the old days, you know, in the Silver Age and the Bronze Age, than we all thought. Then Doug made some comments because, you know, Doug just recently blitzed through all of the Justice League International podcast, started in June and finished in October, listened to every single episode. He has some insight here. He says, the evolution of the show, which may have seemed slow to some of you, felt very rapid at points. For example, the dropping of certain segments when we went from one issue per month to two issues per month, it really annoyed Doug, particularly losing the monitor duty. And he says he got over it, though. Yeah, Doug, I loved the monitor duty segment where we would sit there and talk about what was on the shelves the same months. But the problem is once I went to two issues a month, there's just no way. I mean, the show's already like 2 hours long normally anyway. And that's just way too much to ask someone to listen to. To add even more segments is crazy. Then Doug says, the amount of international guests, particularly English guests, was surprising, with so many of us from the old country had encountered the work and efforts of Martin Gray made me chuckle as to the stories of hunting for issues before comic book stores became a thing. Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Doug. Then this cracks me up. Okay, this is hysterical. So Doug left that comment on the website, right? And then there's a ton of back and forth between Doug and Martin Gray and Captain Entropy and Lizanne Oswald. Just lots of folks going back and forth in this thread. Then they had a very particular discussion, which then Martin Gray, knowing how I do feedback, wrote the next line for me. So here it is. I'm going to say this, but Martin Gray wrote this for me. And I quote, Doug and Martin Gray had a long exchange about the Edinburgh Comic Cons, and if you want to see what they said, go to the show page. Yes, Martin, that is exactly how I handle those kinds of things in the feedback. Thank you so much. All right, up next is Evertom Vieira do Carmo from our Brazil embassy. They also have their own YouTube channel. Now, the channel itself is called Collector's Vault, but it is written in Portuguese, so you're going to have to figure that one out yourself, folks. Evertom wrote, I decided to search my JLI collection to research and make a video about General Glory, and I was surprised to see that the five editions of Justice League America about General Glory were published in numbers 50 and 51 here in Brazil. And as for the Starro story, this is a perfect example of how to balance comedy and how serious these villains are. Yeah, Evertom. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the information about the Brazilian editions. But yeah, Starro story, it's a great balance, exactly like you described. They heard from Tim Price from the Outcasters, Batman and the Outsiders podcast, and the Batgirl and Huntress podcast. Tim says, oh, bravo, uncovering these issues, Shag, Captain Entropy, and JT the Exterminator. You did a great job and such a fun listen. Kudos. Regarding Justice League number 50, he says, could this cover be an homage to Justice League number 2 cover? Antagonist up above, loosely based on a Marvel character, the team writhing in pain, electricity and energy? Maybe. Wow, Tim, that's a great observation. I hadn't thought about that. Then Tim says, now I was wincing at the statement about Shiloh, Mr. Miracle, joining the team. Because if you look at the page again, it's never stated that he's joining. Max is trying to recruit him, and Scott is saying a hard no. And is it a spoiler to say that a character won't be coming back when the story never mentions him again? Well, a 30-year-old comic, so I hope not. But it does reopen the question, why were Shiloh and Scott in the storyline? My feeling was that it played with a guest star trope, thumbing their nose at a guest appearance being for a big reason, and just including the Miracles because they thought it'd be fun, or just to expand the cast for the anniversary issue. Or they had plans later, and the upcoming Breakdown series changed the direction dramatically, so those ideas got scuttled. You know, I don't know. That's a good question, Tim. Now, I will point out that Mr. Miracle did appear in this Justice League quarterly issue. Now, it was Scott Free's costume, but I really got the sense that that was supposed to be Shiloh because they were spending time with General Glory. But interesting. So I didn't realize that Shiloh never appears again. Oh, it's a bummer, but I'll be looking for that. All right, then we hear from Jack Bond, who says, your side comment about ratsies, and whether it's a comic book word or even retconned, remind me of the Three Stooges I saw years and years ago. I haven't found the one I was thinking of, but I did find the Back from the Front from 1943, where towards the very end, Moe shouts out, you ratsy! So it's probably not the only time, or even the first. If, as it so happens, you get thrown back in time, rest assured you can razz ratsies with the best of them. Thank you, Jack. I appreciate the history lesson. Then we'll hear from Mike Dinas from the Pacific Canadian Embassy. Mike says, excellent show and excellent guest, Shag. I've always enjoyed hearing from Captain Entropy. Was even more gobsmacked when you got Starro. Starro! Then Mike goes on to say, that fantastic Kyle Baker story, I laughed out loud at almost every single page. So good. Oh, yeah, you're absolutely right, Mike. Then about Just League Europe, Mike says, Shag, I'm glad you said that Blue Jay did nothing. I've been pretty positive for both teams, but boy, I did not like Blue Jay. I've always thought he was useless. They never really gave him anything to do or say, and he was there mostly just to balance Silver Sorcerer's complaining about their destroyed homeworld. There. I got the grumpy old man yelling at clouds out of my system. So now I can say, I really enjoyed the issue. Thank you so much, Mike. I appreciate it. Then we hear from Martin Gray from our Scottish Embassy and the Two Dangers for a Girl blog. Folks, we love Martin. He says, thanks for another unfeasibly fabulous episode, Shag, with two fresh guests. It's great to hear Captain Entropy, and that skydiving story was amazing. And JT the Exterminator did a brilliant job of fully grabbing the co-host reins. Ah, yeah, Martin, they were great guests, weren't they? I'm so glad people are celebrating them both. And Martin says, the Glory story ended well. I was just glad to see the laughing legend of World War II join the Justice League, because his look is so great. I agree, though, he should have been one to deliver the final blow, not Ice or Orion. Yeah. And then Martin says, I wasn't sad to see Orion or Light Ray D-League. They never settled in with the team. It was always weird when new gods were added on to non-new gods teams. They just don't sit right. The fourth world characters should stick to their own corners of the DCU. The full-on Jack Kirby sensibility doesn't sit well with the regular DCU. Martin, I will point out that both Mr. Miracle and Big Barda were incredible additions to the Justice League International team, but I'm not here to argue with you. You're too good of a friend for that. And then Martin says, Shag, I think you're right about the splash pick of ice running from the falling craft being an homage. It's so familiar. As you say, though, it could just be the Action Comics number one vibe. Yeah, I mean, no one else has chimed in on that, Martin, so I think that it's just you and me. You know, it doesn't appear to be from anything other than just symbolically, maybe. Then we're from Siskoid from the Canadian Embassy. He's also part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. He's on shows such as Hero Points, FW Team Up, and he was the co-host on the role-playing episode I did. He chimed in a lot of those comments as well. But regarding the Justice League issues, he says, isn't it great when you revisit something and it's better than you remember? Yeah, that is awesome, Siskoid. It really was. They were from Jason R. Lady, author of the young adult humorous fantasy novels Monster Problems, Super Problems, and Time Problems. Jason says, Justice League International had a lot of weird cast decisions. When you look at Shiloh, Orion, Light Ray, Dr. Light, Captain Marvel, both Dr. Fates, Animal Man, Wonder Woman, Huntress, it's a constant revolving door. On the one hand, that adds to the chaotic and frenetic vibe of the JLI, but on the other hand, you wonder what was going on behind the scenes that characters kept getting snatched away or given the boot like that. Then regarding Justice League Europe, Jason says, JT the Exterminator's observations on Rocket Red are great ones. Later on in the JLE, after Giffen's off the book, they do get into the implications of the Soviet Union breaking up and the impact on Rocket Red. But Dimitri's not a regular cast member at that point. There was a lot they could have done with Dimitri, and they didn't. JT also raises a good point about Dimitri, and I think it could be applied to guys like Blue Jay and Silver Sorceress, too. If they'd had a higher profile in the JLI, would they have been used for something other than cannon fodder later? It's an excellent question and worth speculating about. After all, as a writer myself, I'm of the opinion there are very few bad or lame or unusable characters. Each one is one good writer or story away from being a well thought of as a classic. Oh, no, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right, Jason. We heard from Heath Fodor, who says that his letter was printed in JLA number 50. That's awesome. All right, folks, now for the last comment. If you're a fan of our Who's Who podcast, you know that I like to end the Who's Who podcast feedback with a long missive from my good buddy, Diablo Frank, who, by the way, who's from the World Spine Podcast Network. He does shows such as The Idle Head of Diablo, which is a blog actually about Martian Manhunter. He does a whole bunch of other shows. But I love to cover Diablo Frank. He's a good friend, and he is one surly, surly bastard. He is an amazing man behind a keyboard. He is terrifying to get a message from, but his insight is always interesting, if not extremely negative sometimes. So here we go. We're going to go into this. And the fun part is he accidentally, seriously, at least I assume it's an accident, copy-pasted his feedback from a previous Who's Who entry we did, all about General Glory, where he ranted about General Glory. And he says he copy-pasted here by accident, but I think there's some good bits in here I'm going to read. So, all right. So first off, about role-playing games. Frank says, I actually did run a single Mayfair campaign with a group of friends in the late 1990s and early 2000s that lasted a number of months. Attempts at a second campaign incorporating more Marvel elements fell apart after a few sessions. I was a terrible GM and my players just maxed out their fighting stats and punched things very hard. It was basically a role-playing as a side-scrolling fighting game, but we had fun with it. Also, my girlfriend has been playing Dungeons & Dragons throughout the pandemic with numerous groups, so I've had a fair amount of peripheral exposure at this point. His girlfriend, she's absolutely wonderful. When you hear the expression better half, this is absolutely true. We love you, Paquita. All right, so going on here, onto the Justice League America issue. Frank's got a bone to pick with some Justice League America stuff. Frank says, I got into the JLI largely because of the art of Kevin Maguire and how it combined with the work of Keith Giffen and James DeMatteis to bring out the best in all involved. Like it or not, Jack Kirby's work was never as good without Stan Lee scripting over it. And even if Maguire was technically better drawing other books, he was never going to have the same impact on Trinity Angels, or even with good writers, on other familiar IPs as he did with Justice League. He will always be the great JLI guy, and especially nowadays, most people want all three on a funny project rather than the constituent parts. There's something to be said for that. The three of them together, Frank, were absolutely magic. Then Frank says, you've made passing references in recent episodes, but who are all these people hanging around? Silver Sorceress and Blue Jay? Orion and Light Ray? Beef Eater? They are all Saturday Night Live. They're all SNL utility players trying to angle for their own skits, but don't have the chops for it. And then we devote a 5-issue arc to Brad Hall. Captain America is one of my all-time favorite superheroes. I should be a sucker for other patriarch heroes, but then the simple fact is that the comics were filthy with him in the Golden Age, and we don't need them anymore. General Glory was such a by-the-numbers lift, and really even more so of Simon and Kirby's Fighting American with its meta-humor, that he arrived at best a third-rate ripoff. For the team struggling with legitimacy in the eyes of the greater fan community, he is so obvious and worthless in addition as to be the JLI's Cousin Oliver. Oh my god! Gosh, Frank, I don't necessarily agree with what you're saying, Frank, but I love reading it. I absolutely do. He goes on later to say, DC Comics definitely paid Kyle Baker a full rate in all his disciplines for his backup story. And by this point, they were very corporate and everything had to have a concrete pay scale. I still have my battered copy of Why I Hate Saturn from the early 90s printing. So please do yourself a favor and get a copy. Again, thank you so much, Frank. I adore you so much. I'm terrified of you as a human being, but I'm glad the planet has someone like you. All right, then we also got some nice comments from other folks such as Adam Ackerman, John Coos, Matt Ev, Lucien Desar, Aaron Headmoss, and Hoover Jeremiah. Thank you so much, guys. I really appreciate it. All right, this is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared the show on their social media timeline. We're talking on Facebook or Twitter. And yes, I am aware this is a long list of names. In case you didn't think I knew that, I do. However, these folks have shared their support and promoted the JLI podcast. They've helped get the word out there, and they've helped grow the audience. So to me, it's really important that we recognize these individuals. And our community is growing again. This time out, we've got nearly 90 names of people to help promote the show. Oh my gosh, I am overwhelmed, you guys. So here is everyone who helped promote the podcast the last couple episodes by sharing on Facebook and retweeting on Twitter. So our thanks go out to Aaron Head Moss, Adamson Attic, Al Girding, Andre TFG, Anibal Carlos Morbo Gutierrez, Between the Pages blog, Billy Delicious, Blue Beetle and Booster Gold Facebook page, Brian Sufo, Canadian Geek, Cheryl Lynn Martin, Chris Franklin, Chris Lewis, Chris Lyde, Clinton Robinson and his Coffee and Comics, Day of High Adventure podcast, and Fan Films Friday podcast, Damian Drew A. Whiter, Dave Steele, Dave's Comic Heroes blog, Denim Jedi, Derek Crabb, Doc RX, Doug Adamson, Adam Ackerman, Dr. Jennifer Swartz Levine, Dr. G Nerdologist, Frederico Hernandez, Geek to Me Radio, Gus Casals, Hoover Jeremiah, Isamu Yukinori, Jason R. Lady, Jeffrey Brown, Joe Tonello, John Coos, John at Changing Shades, John Wilson, JT the Exterminator, Justice Trek, Justin Steiner, Keith G. Baker, Kiko Malpica Ocampo, Con L, Liz Ann Oswald, Lucien Desar, Mark Lax, Martin Gray, Martin Kogan, Matt Ev, Max Romero, Max Traver, Maz Enger 1978, Michael Atchison, Michael Kramer, Michael Thomas, Mike Dynas, Mike Garvey, Mike Jamison, Mo Walker, Nicholas Alheim, Nuno Duarte, Paul Hicks, Paul Kean, Pragmatic Gollum, Pulp Fiction Comics Culver City, Rob Kelly and his accounts for Digest Cast, Treasury Comics, Mountain Comics, and Super Friends for All Mankind Podcast, Rolled Spine Podcast, Scott X, Sean Ross and his Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Siskoid, Steve Gibbons, Symbol Pending, Tall Tower, The Voice of Paul, Tim Price and his Outcasters Batman and the Outsiders podcast, Trent Lewis, Turbo Comics, Warlock Thanos podcast, Wibbly Wobbly Dicey Wicey RPG podcast, Willie Yarbrough, Right On Network, and Zek Cap Boots. Whew, man, you guys have no idea how many times I had to stop to catch my breath in the middle of that. My thanks to all of you for your support of the JLI podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show, folks, and this community of JLI fans we're building together is fantastic. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It is probably the fault of Captain Entropy or JT the Exterminator. Let me know, and I'll be sure to include you in the next episode. Please keep those cards and letters coming, everyone. You can visit our website is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JLI. You can leave your comments on the show post there. That's where most of the activity is going on. You can also find us on Facebook as Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast or Twitter as JLI Podcast, and our email is jlipodcast@gmail.com. My thanks again to Siskoid, Captain Entropy, and JT the Exterminator for appearing on the most recent episodes of the show. And thank you to listeners for such a great collection of feedback. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll see exactly where Steve ended up.
It was a golden age. Our Martian civilization was at the height of its peace and prosperity.
White Martians came from beneath the planet's surface, bringing fire from the planet's guts, and they burned us all.
I lost my family, came to Earth when my civilization was destroyed.
Detective John Jones is what you might call my human alter ego.
I'm not the only thing from outer space that's come, but right now I'm the only thing that can stop alien invasion.
My name is John Jones,
also known as the Martian Manhunter.
I'm Mars' sole survivor. There's a reason for that.
I will defend Earth.
The final head of Yabanu. Podcast available through iTunes, Shout Engine, and the Internet Archive.
Afternoon, everybody.
Ryan!
How's that baby treating you, Mr. Daly?
Like Thanos snapping his fingers at my bank account.
In that case, how about a beer on the house?
Sure. Gotta give my mouth something to do between podcasts.
Say, Ryan, I don't get how you have so much time for podcasting. Doesn't your wife want you spending time with the baby?
Would you? Truth is, I think she's a little worried about how much time I'm spending with the kid, ever since his first words were Dagobah system. Now she wants me to go out and do something mature, something productive, and most of all, something lucrative that can support the family.
So you're going to...
podcast about Cheers, yeah. That kid's not going to start college for 18 years. I got time. Cheers Cast, the podcast where everybody knows your name. Coming soon to the Fire and Water Network.
Hey folks, this is Shag. We're back from break, and I thought it'd be kind of fun. I am here at Rob K.
Kelly's wedding of the Fire and Water Network, just enjoying myself.
Oh, hello, Shag.
Oh, Steve?
Yeah, what are you doing here?
What am I? I'm here for Rob's wedding. What are you doing here?
Oh, they invited you to the wedding, too?
Well, yeah, I walked Kelly down the aisle.
You did?
Were you not paying attention?
Well, to be fair, I had the glasses on, the 3D glasses, and everything was a little blurry, so I mean, you know, whatever.
After a few drinks, everything's a little blurry.
That's so true. Very true.
Well, Steve, I guess since you're here, I will thank you for being on the JLI podcast, so thank you very much for being here.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for crashing Rob's wedding, I guess, as well.
No, I was legitimately invited, unlike some people.
Oh, right. Okay, that's fair. Right. I'll own that. That's okay. A fair hit. So why don't you tell people where they can find more of you besides crashing weddings?
Well, right now they can find me at the Hilton Christiana in Newark, Delaware, as we were here at the post-reception drinks and at the bar in the hotel. It's a fantastic gathering going on here.
But I got to say, Ryan Daly's blue crushed velvet tuxedo was off the chain.
Yes, that's true. You know, and his wife didn't look too embarrassed to see him in it.
She's been dealing with it a long time.
That's true. Yeah. Well, she's a long-suffering soul, we can tell.
He doesn't listen to this show, so he'll never hear this. Don't worry.
But, no, people can find me on social media, Facebook and Twitter. I have a blog. It's a Givens blog that I have ignored for a couple years now, but I do plan to get back to it at some point. And I do appear on the network from time to time when they need someone to come in and spice up the shows a little bit, you know. No, I joke.
Or if he gets enough blackmail on us, like he has this weekend.
Yes, exactly.
Well, Steve, in all seriousness, thank you so much for being here. And thank you for hanging out with me and being my date at the wedding. It's been an absolute blast, so thank you.
It has, like I've been telling you, you're going to pay for this.
I don't even want to think about it. So, folks, that is going to do it. But come back next episode when we cover Justice League America number 51 and Justice League Europe number 27. And we'll have two more guest hosts to help me cover the issues. Who will they be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode.
Well, actually, there's been a slight change of plan. Sorry, folks. But the November episode, instead of featuring those issues of Justice League, instead, we're going to feature an interview with Justice League Europe star artist Bart Sears. Yeah, that's right. I sat down and had an amazing chat with Bart Sears, and you're going to hear that in the November episode. I am so excited for you folks to hear that. Now, also, if some of my other plans come together, and I don't want to say what because I don't want to jinx anything, you might just get another bonus episode in November as well that would be amazing. So watch for that in November.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, I'm Shag.
And I'm Steve.
And you've been listening to the JLI podcast.
Want to make something of it?